Hello, friends. This version of the podcast is brought to you by Onnit.com. O-N-N-I-T.com. Are we sponsored by them? No. But they are a great company. They are a great company.
What is Onnit.com?
They specialize in nootropics. Total human optimization. A little plug there. Wow. Their supplements are the best on the planet. All natural. No crazy stuff. You don't pay taxes at the end. Like some of these supplements, I use all their products. I use Alpha Brain, Shroom Tech, their protein powder, all herbs, all things that you can't get. Nothing's bad in them at all. Check them out. There's a lot of controversy on nootropics, but Google it. Check it out. Nootropics. Nootropics. And take a look for yourself. Be your own judge. Kyle.
Yes, sir.
I haven't seen you in 2 weeks, buddy.
I know. It's been all... I'm happy about that.
And I purposely did not really ask you much about what's going on when I saw you because I wanted to actually do it live and really have a conversation. So what's up, man?
Nothing much.
Doing all right? What have you been doing last since I saw
you? Working. Back at work. Every
back
day.
Back to the grind.
40 hours a week.
You probably work more than that.
No, I really don't.
Really?
If anything, I work less than that.
Do you really?
I leave in the last patient.
Sneaky son of a gun.
I leave in the last patient.
You get your notes done?
Oh, yeah. I don't understand how people don't get their notes done. What do you...
Well, when you're a baller and you see mad patients like I do.
I see a lot of patients. I finish a note before they leave.
You probably don't.
When they go on whatever they're on at the end, during their last exercise, I'm writing the note. I'm finishing the note.
All right. Well, today we're going to talk about, something that I think is pretty interesting. It's called... IASTM,
or
instrument-assisted soft tissue mobilization. I love it because I love manual therapy, and man, after a long day of treating patients with your hands, the last patient of the day, your hands are just shaking, your hands are so sore. This is a great way to save your hands, save your strength, and also, I think they get excellent results. We went over an article last time, but Kyle just went to a course on instrument-assisted soft tissue mobilization.
It was good. They showed a lot of instant results, people getting more range of motion and what have you. It's in conjunction with... I like using my hands, but it's essentially... Well, it is. People have heard the grass and thing. Do you know the story behind that?
I don't know the story, but for everybody that's listening out there, really quickly... instrument-assisted soft tissue mobilization is basically their tools. They almost look like butter knives.
Yeah.
And they're metal tools. And the whole point is you run them over scar tissue, okay? And they're supposed to produce localized inflammatory responses, which brings blood flow to the area, good for healing. They reduce scar tissue, and they break down any existing scar tissue in anybody who's got soft tissue restrictions. So you could pretty much use it on anybody and for any injury.
Yeah.
And what you do is you rub these specific tools, and we won't get into too many of the specifics right now because it's kind of a lot, and that's why you take continuing edit on. But basically, you take these tools, you run them over areas that are tight, that have scar tissue, and these hot spots pop up. These hot spots are where the scar tissue is, and you go from there. But that's what it does. It produces a localized inflammatory response, which is great for blood flow. That's what we want when it comes to healing. Everybody that has ever taken a pathology course knows that. Reducing scar tissue and basically just breaking down all the scar tissue in anybody who's got restrictions. So you're doing the same thing you would be doing with your hands, but you're doing it with tools. Just to give you guys a quick heads up on exactly, what this is that we're talking about. So tell me a little bit about the course that you had. Was it Graston? Was it
no.
Hawk Grip? Was it,
we used
generic
Hawk,
brands?
We used Hawk Grip because you can only get trained, you can only say you're doing Graston if you're certified by Graston, which is a bunch of BS because you're doing the same thing. So even though a doctor asks for Graston, you got to tell them, I'm doing instrument-assisted soft tissue mobilization. And I'm thinking the way that's set up is because Graston screwed himself because he let the patent run out on his tools, and some other guy came along who wanted it, and he tried ordering the tools for his therapist because he wanted the the Grasson. Grasson's like, no, he's got to be trained by us. And the guy was like, well, that's a bunch of crap.
So he
looked it up and he saw the patent ran out on Grasson's tools. So he's like, all right. So he went around asking therapists that use Grasson, what sucks about it, what's good on it. Got feedback, made the Hawk Grip tools, which I even like better.
So let me ask you two questions. One, when you're documenting, you can only say that you use the Grasson technique if you're certified.
Yeah, well, you can say, but you can just get sued by Grasson.
Okay, so you, to be safe, you put...
He's got like a copyright IASTM on the technique, which is the same thing.
Okay.
You're doing the same thing. It just seems like he probably scrambled after he realized, I don't have my patent anymore.
Did you see the Hawk Grip tools compared
we used
to
the
Hawk Grasson?
Grip.
Are they similar?
I have Grasson at my office, and I used Hawk Grip during the thing.
So you've used both. I've only used the generic brand, which, you know, I don't even know actually the name of them, but I know they're not Grasson. I know they're not Hawk Grip. They're just, they really are the cheap generic ones, but they work just as good. Do the Grasson tools and the Hawk Grip tools, do they look alike? Are
look
they
exactly
the same?
Same
Tell me a little bit about that.
Different contours. You got the curved, convex, concave ones. Big, small, weighted. Some are weighted heavy. Some have a fine point. I mean, all different shapes and sizes. It looks like a knife set rolled up. But, yeah, so when you're billing, I just bill manual, and I bill, and I say description is instrument-assisted soft tissue mold.
So how exactly do you put it in your documentation? You don't say Grasson or Hawk Grip. You
just
say...
No, I
just
say
soft tissue mobilization.
Yeah, usually I put it under soft tissue. I mean, that's how our notes are set up.
During the course, I was given a very right before I got hired, literally 2 months before I got hired, our clinic had the course on these tools, so I missed that. So I didn't actually get any handouts. I didn't get any packets. Did they say, specifically who was a very good candidate for this? And did they also say, is there anybody that's, this is not a good candidate for this?
Well,
and going to the technique, how do you apply it?
You don't want to go, you can do subacute, you can do acute, you can do chronic. Obviously, you're not going to go over a tendon. Someone just got a rotator cuff repair, but you can work around the tendon. Depends. If you have a soft tissue restriction, you can use it. I mean, I like using my hands. But on certain things, I mean, I liked it better for low back. I liked it on, even though, again, I like to use my hands with that. The more I think about it, I use it because I think patients, again, think it's like, oh, I'm getting this cool thing. It's not my hands. But I feel like I can feel better with my hands than going to Grasson on top.
So you're thinking maybe a little bit of placebo effect with these?
Well, I think it's another thing that makes your patients come back. Like, oh, I'm getting these cool tools done on me instead of like, oh, my therapist is giving me a massage. Which, I mean, tonight, I like that too, but I think it's another thing like stim. Like, yeah, is it really getting them better? No. But it's something that gets the patient coming back in the door. If it takes that, you have to give them heat and stim in the beginning, even though clinically you're not fixing anything with it. It gets them to come every time because they come for the heat and stim, and then they do other exercises after. I'm for it. A lot of people don't do modalities. Like, oh, I don't do modalities. I don't like heat. The patient likes it. It gets them to come in the door. Why does it matter?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you guys advertise. We don't actually advertise. And I think the reason we don't is because it seems the only people that actually advertise it are the people that do Grasson.
We advertise Grasson. We have two clinicians that do it in our building.
Yeah.
Which is weird, too, though, because the doctor will give me a script. And it's like, I don't know. I'm not going to call him and be like, I don't do this because I'm doing the same thing. So
Now, you did it before you took the course. Did you learn anything at the course? I mean, you were using these tools. You were finding it effective before you even had the course. Now, you took the course. Did you find anything really significantly? Did something really pop out at you that you didn't know or that you had no idea about when you took the course that you didn't know before you?
No. I mean, just different body mechanics, how he positioned himself for certain things, like doing a scap, sideline, or whatever, having them sideline for certain things that I just didn't think of right away.
I didn't, at first I was a little apprehensive to use the tools because I like using my hands when it comes to my manual techniques. But over time, I've started to develop an acquired taste, so to speak, for the IAA stem tools because, you know, I really like it for quad tendon and patellar tendon stuff.
Yeah, I agree. That's
I seem to find that the lower extremity things, any kind of pathology involving the lower extremity, for some reason I really enjoy using the tools. And I always, and even if I do use them, I always use them in conjunction, okay, with manual techniques with my hands and also, you know, always therapeutic exercise and modalities.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's just like a manipulation. Like, I mean, it's not going to fix them, but it makes them get through the exercises. They get good full range. You get someone full range before they do shoulder flexion, whatever. Do that for 10 minutes. Now they can get their shoulder from 0 to 180. I mean, even there's a guy, he just labor repair, like far out. He had like 160. He worked on his shoulder 5 minutes. He was at 175. It was just, and the patients like to see that and stuff.
Yeah. I knew we were going to talk about this today. So I had a patient who was recovering from rotator cuff surgery. And I normally do, you know, passive range of motion. You know, I stretch her, capsular pattern. I always do, you know, external rotation, abduction stretches, you know, internal rotation, flexion. But I also do, you know, the mobilizations with the capsular pattern. So I almost always do that. I do a lot of soft tissue work. And she's been getting great results, range of motion-wise. You know, in conjunction with the therapeutic exercises, all the stretching, wall slides. You know, and then you know, when they get to that point, you can do TheraBand stuff and strengthen them. But I knew we were doing this today, and I had never done those tools with her. So today, I actually ran the tools on the, you know, supraspinatus, infraspinatus. I did a little bit of biceps tendon, upper trap, levator, scapula. Just to look for, you know, to see if, you know, her passive glenohumeral horizontal adduction and interrotation got better. So I did it today. I'm going to check, and I'm just going to see, you know, and also placebo effect. I just want to see when she comes in on Monday, is she going to say, hey, you know, you did that on me yesterday, and that felt amazing. For the most part, whenever I use these tools, I have a very positive response.
Yeah.
I've been working now for about 16 months. I've never had somebody say, you know what, I didn't like that, or it didn't help. Usually you break, you know, that's what you're doing. You're breaking up scar tissue, and it's great. You know, you could see it. The thing I like about it is when you're running those tools and those hot spots pop up, you know that you're breaking up that scar tissue.
You can actually see it. And on the legs especially, you can feel that you run the tool over their leg. It's like you're running over a bumpy road. It's like speed bumps. But your thumbs, you run under the stimulator of your hands, you don't feel it at all. On the legs. I mean, you can feel knots in someone's back and scap, I feel like. But on the legs, like on a hamstring, you run your hands in there, it'll feel all nice and smooth. You do it with the tools, and that thing's, like, shaking. It's good. It in conjunction with other things. Again, with everything.
Now, I said for me, you know, I have the lower extremity stuff. A lot of patellar tendonitis, a lot of, you know, quadriceps tendon stuff. Any pathologies involved in that? Do you have a specific body part or a specific pathology that, you know, that, like, the tools are your go-to, Kyle?
Plantar fascia.
Oh, that's another good one.
But people don't like that.
That's another good one.
Patients hate that. But, I mean, again, because my thumbs are, I got good thumb strength, but my thumbs aren't very big. So
you have phenomenal thumb strength, Kyle.
Thank you, buddy.
You really do. Phenomenal.
So it's nice having the tools because, I mean, after a while, my thumb can only do so much and that scarring can just jump out of the way. It escapes my thumb. There's no escaping the tool. That's good. Actually, you know what the course? The best thing I learned in that course is a pec minor release.
You did it with the tools?
No. Well, you can, but I didn't. I mean, I did it with my hands. But I didn't realize how far you can get up and down to that pec minor.
Pec minor release is a very... My little shout out to Dr. Rodeo, Nick Rodeo. He taught me the pec minor release in my first orthopedic clinical rotation. And man, what a difference that makes. That is a hidden gem. If you got a patient that, you know... Almost everybody has, you know, a lot of people have poor posture. So they're sitting with their rounded shoulders, okay, protracted shoulders, okay, their forward head, they're leaning over. And we always teach, you know, sit up nice and straight. And how do we do that? You know, we do scap squeezes. We work on rhomboid strengthening, all that kind of scapular strengthening. But over time, when you're sitting with those rounded shoulders and that forward head over and over and over again, the pec minor and your anterior structures become so tight. That when you finally, you know, we always think about, okay, well, they've got these rounded shoulders, they're protracted, you got the forward head, So almost every clinician that I know, including myself, you know, what do you do for that? You know, you work on upper trap stretching. You know, you work on scap squeezes. You work on rows. You work on lat pull downs. Mm-hmm. You're working on everything to bring those shoulders back, retract those shoulders, okay, and sitting up nice and straight with the head. But a lot of times, we don't work manually on the anterior structures. Like, I'll have to, sometimes I'll have a patient come two or three times and I'll go, oh man, I haven't worked on their anterior structures at all. And you do a pec minor release with somebody for the first time, yeah, it doesn't feel the greatest, but they'll come back to you the next visit and say, man, that felt absolutely excellent. You know, and you could really see them starting to sit up nice and straight and their posture. But that pec minor release is a hidden gem. That's something for everybody out there who's doing PT, and you got somebody that when you're working postural education with somebody, don't just worry about the posterior structures, which is, you know, scapular strengthening and all that. You know, do some manual therapy to those anterior structures. You know, give them the full boat. Did you work on did you do a pec minor release on somebody yet since you did it?
No, but I've had patients in the past, car accidents, that seatbelt, like, I mean, this crossing over right over that area. And then also, I mean, and that's the one thing you got to watch out for is if you do it on a female, get permission first, get her to hold hold her own goods, pull
you
it over
got,
one side. I found that
that's
not
power your foot, your mouth,
no, but learning that in the course too. Just how do you go about doing that? Like, I mean, that's always a conversation.
Well, also too, whenever that does happen, I almost always have another coworker there with me.
Yeah, that's true. But most 9 times out of 10, the patient's fine with it.
Yeah, 9 times out of 10 they are. But you know what? It never hurts to have.
No.
Never hurts to have somebody.
We don't have any other. We don't have female therapists though. So I mean, you say what you're going to do. You explain it. If you know what you're talking about, they're not going to question it.
Yeah. Yeah. You just got to be very very thorough with your explanation.
Yeah. Make
so
sure you. Explain,
there's no surprises.
Make sure you drape.
No surprises. Yeah. So basically, you know, and guys out there. Just, you don't even have to do a good search engine. Just type in Google, and you'll find so many research articles that have to do with, you know, there's a really good one in the International Journal of Sports Physical Therapy talking about the acute effects of instrument-assisted soft tissue mobilization for improving posterior shoulder range of motion in collegiate baseball players. That passive internal rotation is huge for baseball players. And, you know, they seem to do a lot of research for pitchers and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what, I haven't found any randomized control trial out there that didn't have very positive effects and significant differences in patients who had the Graston, Hawk Grip, instrument-assisted soft tissue mobilization group compared to manual therapy only. I've yet to find, you know, there's so many of them, so I, you know, I really didn't pick one to talk about, like kind of like we did last time, but I have not found one article where there was either no change or, you know, a negative change. Everybody did better. So I think the big take-home message with the instrument-assisted soft tissue mobilization is it's a great tool to have in your arsenal.
Definitely.
You know, learn how to do it. Practice it, even if you're not comfortable doing it at first. The more and more you do it, your patients will come back to you more and more and say, man, that felt really good. So it's not going to be the only thing that you do, but you're going to do that in conjunction with, you know, mobilizations with your hands, soft tissue mobilization with your hands, massage, that kind of stuff, and, you know, different kind of releases, like you were just saying, you know, pec minor releases, all the things that you learn while you're in school and all those manual techniques that we have that I think really separate us from, you know, what I think separates a really good therapist and an average therapist is their manual therapy skills.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. You know, to take manual therapy out of the equation, two people coming up with an individualized therapeutic exercise program and modalities for somebody, for the most part, you're going to have two people. You know, somebody who does the generalized program for somebody and somebody who really tries to individualize it for them, they're going to be pretty much the same. You know, the person who really goes above and beyond maybe might have a slightly better program, but really what makes a therapist go from an average therapist to, in my opinion, a good and great therapist is their manual therapy skills. When I have a patient and I ask them, have you ever had physical therapy before? And they say yes. And let's say they're there for their low back. Okay, well, what did you do? Oh, well, you know, I went through my first visit. They gave me a bunch of exercises, and they saw me for two or three visits, and then they sent me home, and they, you know, they told me I was done with therapy. And then I asked them, did they do any manual therapy with you? Oh, no, they didn't touch me at all.
Yeah, so, I've gotten that.
I think that's crazy.
You're strictly talking about outpatient, though. You can't judge an acute care therapist isn't going to be doing MOBs on people.
No, they're not going to be doing MOBs, but they're going to be stretching. They should be stretching patients.
Yeah, all right. I'm just saying, I wouldn't refer to just as manual. Just when you are coming in hands-on stuff, you have a patient who works in the hospital that doesn't know how to transfer someone right, or doesn't transfer because they're nervous or whatever, what have you be.
Right. But working in a hospital, you know that your main thing is going to be bed mobility, transfers. Okay, in skilled nursing, it's going to be bed mobility, transfers, walking. In inpatient neuro, okay, you're going to be doing a lot of bed mobility, transfers, all that stuff. But you still have time to do hands-on manual therapy.
Yeah, you do.
And hands-on could be anything from just a simple hamstring stretch to a grade 5 mobilization and everything in between.
Okay, yeah. We're on the same page.
So, there's more hands-on. There's more time for hands-on, and I think it's expected more in outpatient. But really, the difference between an average therapist and a good or great therapist is their manual skills. And not even just their skills, the fact that they either do or don't do them. You know, that drives me absolutely crazy. Absolute bananas, I get when somebody tells me.
Yeah, I don't understand people that say, like, I'm not, like, how come my other therapist never stretched me? Or I don't know. I mean, I understand it. People are lazy. It's what it is.
There's no checks and balances system. One of my good friends who you know, and I won't mention his name, is, you know, one of the best professors we've ever had. And he worked in the military. And in the military, they have something called advanced care, which for anybody who doesn't know that out there, you know, military PTs can write scripts. They can read MRIs. They can write for MRIs. They can read x-rays and write for x-rays. But they do 2 years of training after getting their doctorate. So they get your DPT, then you go into this advanced care. So they're not just doing it with, you know, just some Joe Schmo. You know, they've got a PT who's had 5+ years experience, an internal medicine doctor, and a radiologist. That's their teachers. So that's who's teaching them how to do this. So it's 2 years of, and it's a checks and balances system. If they're writing too many MRIs, you know, they'll sit them down and say, hey, why are you writing all these MRIs? You know, and they have somebody to answer to. You know, in just the civilized world where we have physical therapists, there's no checks and balances system. So you could be a lazy therapist and just do, you know, just do the same amount that you do for everybody. You know, you don't go above and beyond. You don't do manual. You just give somebody exercises. You have no bedside manner. And nobody's going to ever know. Or you could be the guy who goes above and beyond, does manual with everybody, spends time educating, and really just embracing that patient and then giving them your all. Either way, it doesn't matter. If you're in healthcare, you're a PA, if you're a physician, a nurse practitioner, and so on and so forth, there's a checks and balances system. You can't just be lazy. You can't just, you know, if you just wrote everybody an MRI, you know, there'd be some serious problems, especially for people who didn't need them. And that's just one example. But I think the problem is, you know, kind of got off on a tangent about that, but, well, I did, you didn't, but is
get it off your chest.
You know, it's just, there's a big difference between a fair and average therapist and a good or great therapist. And I think that's the manual skills. And that has to be something that's within you. Unfortunately, I wish there was a checks and balances system.
Yeah, we're coming out. We're only a year out. Some of these PTs might get burnt out.
That's true. So that's the take-home message. It's good stuff. Graston, Hawk Grip, instrument-assisted soft tissue mobilization. Try it out, man. Try it out, ladies and gentlemen.
Do it.
See what you think. And if your clinic doesn't have it, just type in instrument-assisted soft tissue mobilization, and a lot of videos will pop up. You can learn it on the fly. If you're a director, if you're in an outpatient clinic and your director, you know, you could bring the video to them, educate yourself, learn about that technique, sit down with your director or your manager and say, hey, I think this is a really awesome technique. It's new. It's, you know, something that, you know, people are getting great results with. Let's think about getting these tools. And more often than not, they'll probably abide and say, yeah, you know, let's do it. So that's the take-home message there. Kyle, I'm glad that you were able to share some insight on that. I'm glad that you enjoyed yourself.
But let's talk about something more academic.
So, speaking...
Academia. I mean, instrument-assisted soft tissue mobilizations, you know, anyone understands that. Let's talk about something serious, and that's bathrooms.
I got to tell you. I do have to tell you.
It's
the biggest nuance and the biggest pain in the butt.
Hold on. Let's introduce... Well, my thing is, this is for people whose clinics have bathrooms in the middle of the clinic. And to me, it's just the strangest thing.
Well, it's not the fact that they're in the middle of the clinic. It's the fact that it's the patient's bathroom, but the therapist
mind sharing the bathroom. It's in the... Like, if I'm not holding it in and I have to go to take a piss or whatever have you want to call it, when I have to go pee, I go into the bathroom, I have to come out, the patient's right there.
He knows
I just used the bathroom. So now not only am I washing, I mean, obviously I'm going to wash my hands, but I wash my hands, dry my hands with the automated thing so they hear the towels because I want them to hear
go
that I know
go
I'm
above beyond.
I come out, I alcohol my hands, I'm wiping my hands down so they see. Because, yeah, like, imagine a doctor doing that. You go to the doctor and you're sick, and right before he comes in, he says, excuse me. He goes into the bathroom, comes over, shaking it. It's just weird. Like, why would you ever design a building? I didn't design the building. And I don't know why you would not have a private bathroom. And I haven't talked to a patient about it because I don't want to bring it up if they're not noticing it, which they might not be.
More than likely they are, and they're just not saying anything because it's a weird thing to say.
Say you're going to stretch someone. Say you're going to do... Say even you're going to do, like cervical traction. And someone's on the table ready to go, and they see you coming out of the bath. I mean, like, you have... I drink coffee at work, man.
Well, that's
exactly... Forget about it. I drink 2 or 3 cups of coffee. I'm running. I should probably count. It's like,
well,
5 or 6 times. Maybe I have the bladder of an old man. Maybe
on our first podcast, the one that we did not put out because of all the lies and language, we talked about our health kick that both of us are on. It's not a diet. It's a lifestyle change. I have a big bottle. Actually, I have it here with me. This is 1.5 liters. I drink one of these in the morning before lunch. Fill it up at our cooler. I drink one of these before I leave. And then I fill it up again right before I leave. And between the gym and everything else, I try to finish one more. You know, I'm following this, you know, lifestyle. You know, Mike Dolce, we'll get into that another time. His big thing is, you know, the body is almost 70% water. You gotta drink a ton of water. And you do. You feel amazing when you're drinking a ton of water. But the point is, I'm drinking a ton of water on top of the 3 or 4 cups of coffee I have a day. So I'm going in and out, you know, every 20 minutes, and it's not embarrassing. It's not something that, you know, I should be ashamed of or anything like that.
No.
But I'm in the middle of my clinic, and you're just going in and out. And this is every outpatient clinic I've ever been in. It seems like that's the only bathroom that you
yeah.
can use as a therapist
it's
is the same one.
Strange,
and it's just funny because I'll open the door, and they're looking right at me, the patient.
I mean, I guess those other doctors' offices have their own, like, treatment rooms, but it's just strange to me. Maybe we notice it because it, like, and we're self-conscious about it, but it's just to me, like, I wouldn't want to see someone coming out of the bathroom before they put their hands on me. Like, it wouldn't bother me, like, it's whatever, but, like, I wouldn't want to see it, and I could understand if someone was, like, uncomfortable.
Exactly.
I mean, touching their neck and around their face. Rather use the bathroom. So, I mean, I hold it a lot of the times. And then...
Well, yeah, and depending on the patient, you know, you could be there for 45 minutes or you could be there for almost 2 hours. Let's say you're there for 2 hours and, you know, I see Buddha over here running in and out of the bathroom 5 times in 2 hours. I'm going to be...
Right.
Hey, what's going on with this guy here? Everything good over there? You doing all right, man? You got to get your prostate checked there, buddy.
Maybe that's it, too. I'm 26 and I piss 10 times a day. Maybe that's the problem. I don't know, that could be the problem.
But that's the thing. A million questions go through your head. And if anything else, it's just funny. And it's a little bit embarrassing. And outpatient clinics are typically wide open.
It's just, if you're going to open a clinic, it would behoove you? I don't think that's right either. It would be in your best interest to put the bathroom in the back. That's all I'm saying.
So you used a 50-cent word and you didn't even know how to pronounce it.
I had to get it off my chest.
We'll have to look that up.
Yeah, we'll look that up.
That word. So what do you... So what's the take-home message here? I mean, what do we do, Buddha? What do we do about it, Buddha?
Use alcohol after you leave the bathroom. That's my go-to.
So you just go above and beyond.
Let them know your hands are clean. You should be washing your hands anyway. You're a weirdo if you don't wash your
so
hands.
So you're saying if the clinic was empty, you wouldn't wash your hands? Oh, God.
Well, I'm just saying, if you're going to touch somebody after you use the bathroom, I don't want to get a whole into this because I can really go off on it.
Well, that's the point of the podcast. You know, I will almost guarantee you, everybody that's listening to this, that's an outpatient, has the exact same problem.
Well, probably.
It seems like outpatient clinics is the main culprit because it's in such a space.
Well, yeah.
It's an open space and everybody sees everything and everybody knows everybody. It's like the big thing. It's just like anything else. Like, you know, you have an issue with somebody at work. You work at a hospital. You work at a school. You know, you can go up a floor, down a floor. You can get away from it. You can go into your office. In PT and outpatient, you are in a square box.
Mm-hmm. We're just talking number ones, so we can end it there.
Well, yeah, but I'm just saying.
I don't want to go to number two.
You do not want to go to number two. That would get dirty.
We just lost all credibility.
We lost all credibility right then and there.
We'll be back in a minute.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are back. So it's Friday at about 7:36. And I have to make an apology to everybody who's listening. I didn't even mention that this is episode 2 of the Tandem Stance podcast. And you're probably thinking, man, I'd like to tell some friends and family where I can find them. And where could you find them, Kyle? You can find them at TandemStance.com. TandemStance.com. You can shop the iTunes store. You can go to Podomatic.com. That's Podomatic.com. Search Tandem Stance. And last but not least, you got a podcast app on your phone, which everybody does if you have an iPhone. Just type Tandem Stance in there. Boom! It's over.
All right, let's do it. Let's get into it.
So again, my apologies for not saying that in the beginning, but that's where you can find us. We appreciate all the subscribers more and more every day. All the fan questions are great. They just keep getting more and more between work and trying to figure everything out. I mean, This is becoming really something awesome, and me and Kyle are really enjoying it, and we're glad that you guys are enjoying it.
All right.
Now, current events. For those who listen to the first podcast, you know that up next is current events. And it's sad. It was a sad day a couple weeks ago in the HBO show True Detective Season 2. It was a sad, sad time for everybody involved.
It didn't live up to it.
For those who watch True Detectives, or it's True Detective, excuse me, season one, I think everybody could pretty much agree on, even if you didn't think it was the best show you ever saw, something like that, everybody will say that season one was a great show. It was a great show. The expectations for season two were through the roof, which I think was a little bit a part of the problem.
No. Because it was just a bad show.
But, regardless, it was a bummer, man.
We're talking about that it's a bad show because of season one. That's why we're talking about how bad it was. But it was bad. It wasn't because my expectations were high. It's because it was bad.
Yeah, like if that was season one, or
I wouldn't have watched. All the reason I kept watching it was because it was True Detective. I'm like, this might go somewhere. But no. Although the acting was good. Colin Farrell, you're good. Richard McAdams, you're good. Vince Vaughn, you were miscast. It wasn't your fault. It wasn't your fault.
It wasn't, was it?
I don't think so. Miscast. Completely.
And Riggins, Taylor Kitsch. I didn't think he did a great job. He was awesome as Riggins. He was awesome in X-Men. But I agree with you 100%. The show stunk. It was terrible. The writing was terrible. It was all over the map. There was 14 too many plot points.
There wasn't anything good. It was like your cut of the mill cop show. That's cable. I don't watch HBO for that.
Right. But I also agree with you that individually, Rachel McAdams, I thought, did a pretty good job.
I give Rachel McAdams a B++.
Colin Farrell got an A.
He got an A.
He did very. I enjoyed every scene that he was in. I thought he did a great job. Vince Vaughn is a phenomenal actor. That just wasn't his role.
Maybe there was a different director. The first season had a different... The director was... And I can't pronounce his last name.
Nick Palooza?
No, that's the writer. Nick Palazzo or something like that. The director was something Fukujima. I'm going to butcher it, so... Look it up. The director of season one. He's freaking awesome, man.
Well, Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson, who were just two just dominant forces,
right,
in season one. They were writers on the first. They were also writers
on
the second. Producer, excuse me. Thank you.
Not
for
writers.
They were producers on the first, which, you know, great. But they were also producers in the second season.
I think you are only as good as your director. I'm not taking anything away from McConaughey. I thought he was awesome in season one. But the director tells you what to do and how to do it. And, I mean, I'm sure they give the actor some latitude with the character, but the director is directing what's going on, how you're saying it, when you're saying it, how you're, like, what you're feeling. You're in, like, the director puts you into the character. Different director. And maybe if it had a different director, the season would have been good. Again, the show, like, hints at things and then, like, doesn't go there, like with Rachel McAdams' dad. Like, what the hell was that? Like, he was in a picture with all these people? Like, why are you setting it up to be like, oh, there's something more? No, there's not.
Yeah, well, they did that quite often. It's like, okay, you think something more is going to happen, and then it never
does.
But
season one did that too, but season one was still, like, was awesome about it. But season one, it was like, what else is going on here? Is Woody Harrelson's, like, father-in-law involved? Is Woody Harrelson involved? Is Woody Harrelson's daughter, like, did she get to, like, and then it ends up just being the guy in the lawnmower. And it's like,
but
why? Like, how? Like, it can't be just, you can't have all
that. But those questions were answered. Those questions were answered. That's the point.
No, they don't
mention.
In
season two,
ooh,
they bring up a million points. They have a million little teasers all right, going.
Let me run something by.
And then all of a sudden, they vanish.
Let me run by. In season one, the two little girls, Woody Harrelson's children, are on, like, a boat. And the daughters are talking, and they're like, she's like, like, ask grandpa, blah, blah, blah. And the one daughter goes, no, like, you ask him. He only talks to you. Like, in a weird, like, hint. And then she drew the thing in the book with, like, the girl getting, you know, raped and everyone was around her. It's like, oh, is this girl involved with, like, Woody Harrelson's father-in-law? And it's like they never talk about it. And it's like everyone thought that was a theory. It's like,
well, I think she drew that picture because remember the two 16-year-old or the two 18 and 19-year-old kids raped her. Remember, they were in jail.
Yeah, but she drew it when she was, like, six.
Oh, she drew it way before.
She got raped when she was, or she got
some. Maybe it was
statutory.
No. But that's well, I don't know. That's a good.
I'm saying the show hints at things, which is fine because season one had so much to it, and, like, it didn't take away from it. But this season, again, you thought, like, oh, maybe there is going to be something more here, and it just wasn't. It was so convoluted and, like, what's going on? Nobody knew what the hell was going on. I rewatched the entire thing before the finale because I'm like, I'm going to invest
mm-hmm.
in this before
yep.
I judge it. And, like, it just let me down.
I never watched a show before where I was rooting so, like, every episode, I was rooting so hard.
No, you were trying so hard to like
it. Trying so hard to like it.
Trying to like it. Everyone was.
I tried to find silver linings after every episode. You know, I knew it wasn't good, but I would try to talk myself into liking it. And then I'd be like, you know, the next episode's going to be awesome. You know, something's coming great for the next episode. Let down. I do the same thing over and over and over. I even got to the last episode where I said, you know what? This has been nothing but a bust. But this eighth episode, man, it's all going to come together. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be suspenseful. It's going to be action-packed.
It wasn't.
You're
going to
find out all the questions. Nothing. Nothing.
Even, like, what was his whole, like, Colin Farrell is this guy doing all this crazy-ass shit during the whole thing. And then, oh, they're following me. I'm done. I'm going to die. Like, out of nowhere? It's like, what, how'd you go from, like, you were just doing some killing, like marine op stuff, and then it's like, oh, I'm getting tailed now. This is it. I'm dead.
My favorite part is, with that, is that he drives his car into the woods.
You know why, though?
And runs away from civilization.
Well, because the only reason that was in the show is, again, it's writing for, like, plot conveniences, because when he had that dream early on, his dad says, I had a dream where you were running through the woods. You were small. The trees were big. You got shot down. The dad said it in episode 3 how he was going to die.
Yeah, but if you knew a crew, a platoon of Green Berets soldiers were coming after you, I would go to the busiest place that I could find so that they couldn't just shoot me in broad daylight because I know they would get caught.
Mm-hmm.
You don't go to the woods in the northwestern United States.
It was very
America.
Strange. It was all very strange.
And then, you know, even there's so many. I mean, you could talk about every episode. You could talk about everybody. you know, how disappointed you were. I mean, there were so many times I was just so let down.
So if Green Berets were chasing you, you would drive to a public place?
And I would just stay there. Until, well, yeah, because, I mean, they could, you know, if you're in the middle of the woods, they'll take you out, nobody will ever know about it.
Would you drive to a subway? See what I did there? I segued to our next topic.
You know, interesting that you would talk about subways.
If anyone doesn't pay attention, Jared Fogle is his last name.
His last name
doesn't
is
Jared
Fogle.
Doesn't Jared Fogle just sound like a...
The subway guy.
Jared Fogle. Just,
Jared the subway guy.
It just sounds like... If you hear Jared Fogle, you're like, yeah, child molester.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense when you hear his name, but... And I don't mean to laugh about it because it's totally not funny, but... So Jared Fogle, for those who don't know, was arrested for, I believe, child pornography. And did 14 he also,
children as young as six. Oh,
did he
my
also,
God.
Did he also have sexual relations with the
I don't
children?
Know, but that's bad.
Either way, I don't know the
He
whole
has thing. A medical problem. Well, of course he's got a medical problem.
Is that what they, is that, was that part of their defense?
He's got a, of course you're a sicko if you do stuff like that.
Let's read this. Former Subway pitchman Jared Fogle has admitted that he had sex with at least two minors. Oh, so he did. And obtained child pornography of 12 other children. Wow. As young as 6 years old, jeez, that is just the most
awful.
Disgusting.
See,
I actually just got the. Oh,
there's things
gracious,
like that.
Terrible.
There's. Just put him in prison for a long time. I don't even know what you do. Send him to an island.
As part of the there's a plea deal here, which I don't understand at all. As part of a plea deal, Fogle signed with prosecutors. For starters, he's a married father of two. I can't.
Oh, they're all married. They're all.
You know. So he faces between 5 and 12 and a half years in prison and has agreed to pay $1.4 million restitution to his 14 victims. He also faces a fine of up to $500,000. How is he not just thrown away in jail, lock the key, lock the door, throw the key away, and just let him rot? How is that not the... How is he out on bail?
There's some things that are just backwards in the justice system.
My goodness, if that's not a peek into the what's wrong with the justice system, I don't know. I'm not quite sure.
If he got caught with drugs, he'd go to prison for longer, which is weird. I mean, if you think about what's the worst crime,
that is really something that is absolutely not only disgusting, but I'm as disgusted as I am with the fact that he would do this. Anybody would do this. You know, of course it makes all this headline news because he's a subway guy. Well, if anybody, we're talking about anybody that would do something like this, I am so not okay with...
It's gross.
I'm just so not okay with the punishment. I mean, that's insane that it's
and
that
these
small
people,
of a
these
thing.
People have no... they have like the highest rate of like they'll relapsing. Like there's no, like there's something wrong.
Yeah,
there's like a sickness. If you can classify it as a sickness, there's something wrong.
Now, what would that sickness be? I mean, his defense attorney, who says here his
they're
name
sick.
Is Jeremy
they can't be cured.
Margolis. Jared also knows that he has a medical problem. He has already sought evaluation by a world-class psychiatrist, experienced in these matters, and he will seek appropriate treatment. Now, really, that's their defense, is
whatever.
That there's a medical issue there?
But again, so you go to, like, then you get placed in the, you think all these people have medical problems, and you're in a, wherever you want to put them, if you find prison's not the place, put them in an insane, whatever, lock them up.
So what's the, but here's my question I'm asking
you.
What's the medical problem?
You know what, well, they
what would the diagnosis be for that?
I think they think these people have, like, they can't control.
Is it genetic? Is it a gene thing? Or is
probably.
It pathology and the neurotransmitters? I mean, what is it?
Probably. I don't know. I don't think people are pouring money into understanding.
That'd be interesting to talk to a psychiatrist about that and ask them.
That
know,
would be interesting.
He,
do you know a psychiatrist?
I don't. He's seeking, he probably should, right? He's seeking a psychiatrist who says it has experience.
I'm sure if you started thinking those thoughts.
Oh, I do. I do. My cousin's next door neighbor is
whoa,
a psychiatrist in Pittsburgh.
Oh, you do know a psychiatrist. Because the way that sounded was that you have this stuff.
Oh, no. I do know.
I know you don't.
No, my aunt and uncle live in Pittsburgh, and they're...
Let's get them on. Get them on the show.
Oh, I should get them on. Their neighbor is... It's a husband and wife. The wife's an endocrinologist for the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, and he also, and the father, the male, is a geriatric psychiatrist.
You know
I
what
believe.
Fogel's from? It's from Superbad. That's the kid's name. McLovin's real name.
McLovin's is Fogel, isn't it?
Yeah. And he, that nothing against that actor, but yeah, I could see it with him too.
Yeah, I'm just, yeah, that's something that, you know, for everyone who's listening, you know, you want to say, you know, this is something that we're, you know, anybody in the world could hear this, and you want to say something smart, and you want to say something, but there's nothing to say other than just, that's just so disgusting on so many levels, and
mm-hmm.
I mean, I just, you know, medical, I think that's just such a terrible defense, coming out and saying, oh, well, I have a medical issue. Really? I don't believe there's a medical issue there.
It's not like he's pleading insane. I think he's just saying out loud, like, for sympathy's sake.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I think when you make that defense as a medical problem, I mean, his punishment is not that harsh, man. $1.4 million he has to pay to four. Now, that's total to, I don't know how they get divided up to 14
victims.
Yeah, but
you're acting like because he said he had a medical problem, he got a lesser sentence.
They're just saying
he has a medical problem. They're not saying like, oh, give us leniency, I have a medical, it's I have a problem.
The reason I think,
judge me like I'm an awful person, I can't help it, it's a disease.
The reason I think that he did get a lesser charge because of that is,
he got a lesser charge because he's going to pay them $1.4 million.
I don't think that's anything. Those kids are going to have to.
Can you look it up right now? Can you look up, Google the average sentence for...
Average sentence for...
Possession of child porn.
Oh, well, so not only did he have sexual relations, but he also had child pornography.
Yeah.
So, let's see here. Average sentence of... Sex offenders comes right up, so let's see what that has to say.
There you go.
Quick facts. Mandatory minimum penalties. Let's say, so you got the mandatory minimums, and you got the...
Yeah, let's just see what the mandatory minimums are.
Let's see. For the United States. Because that just... When I read $1.4 million, and I read 5.5 to 12 years of jail, that just seems so little. Like, what's Sandusky getting? I mean, that
He's
was
got life, but he did way worse. It's all worse. It's all bad. But.
Let's see what it says here. Okay.
What's those? There's charts there.
There's a lot of charts here, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, wow. There is a lot of charts, but it doesn't actually give out any kind of facts saying.
Mandatory? Yeah, right there.
Mandatory minimums. It talks about drugs, powder, crack, heroin, marijuana, meth, geez. But it doesn't say anything about...
That's a different one. Whatever.
Oh, here you go.
We'll try finding it. We'll bring it back up. Let's talk about something more...
Either way, I believe that is just a disgusting, disgusting... And speaking of disgusting, for all those who didn't know, which I was one of them, there's apparently a website called AshleyMadison.com. Kyle, are you familiar with AshleyMadison.com?
I know of it.
Well, their slogan, okay, you ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
Which is just a pun. Life is short.
Mm-hmm.
Have an affair.
It's funny.
Well, it's comical that with all of the, you know, people are hackers, right? Everybody loves to hack into stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We're constantly, you know, one of our biggest threats for terrorists in this country, like one of our biggest, what we spend the most money on defense-wise, you know, Department of Defense, is... you know, internet stuff is all.
I love these hackers. They're funny. They go after these people.
I'm glad that they're going after people like that.
But at the same time, like, people get mad at the website. You're mad at the people who use the website.
Well, that's the thing. So, you know, all these people, apparently, you know, 32,000, something like that, were exposed. I don't know the exact number, but I know it was quite a bit.
Yeah, it was a lot.
They were exposed for. So, what this is it's a website where
it's
you
a lot
go
of people,
if you're
man.
Married. Dude, you put your email address on there. You put your name. I mean, they have a whole, they have an entire, how about this? A reported 40 million people signed up.
40 million?
40 million people are out there.
There's
with
like
a wife or with a
40
husband.
40 people listen to this.
There's 40 million people that were all that this became public. So what you do is you go to this website according to what I'm reading. You go to this website and it's a whole thing. You know, what you're into. What you're just socially, like what you like to do, you know, this person likes to bowl, this person likes to...
It's a dating website for married couples.
So it's a dating website for married couples with the idea of... And it's an affair. I mean, you know going into it, that's what you're going to do. And it's astonishing that these people are actually... They're surprised that this website got hacked.
Yeah, I would die. Yeah, it's just funny to me.
I mean, all it takes is one angry person that got cheated on or got something that, you know, isn't...
It's like, yeah, it's a stupid... I mean, it's a crude website. It's, like, messed up, but...
Well, it's messed up beyond belief. I mean, the fact that people are... I don't know what's more messed up.
But the thing is, I just don't understand why don't you just, like... why can't you just be on a regular dating website? If you're going to have an affair, like, you're already lying, so, like, why do you...
Well, what are some of the major dating websites, like...
eHarmony.
So, like,
Match.
So take a thing like eHarmony.
Plenty
or Match.
Of Fish.
Okay, that's
Zeus.
That's out in the open, and I think it's more like, you know, obviously it's supposed to be for single people. So if you're on that website,
yeah, but you're already lying. You're already lying. You're cheating on somebody. You're lying. So why don't you just lie and just hook up with somebody who like? Why are you going? I guess because it's easier, maybe.
Or,
but you're already lying.
I guess the idea would be that there's an understanding between both
parties. I think there's
parties.
A guarantee that you're going to get some because you're on a site to cheat. You don't on a dating site, you're not guaranteed to get some. You're guaranteed maybe to get a date. You're not even guaranteed to get a date.
And you're probably...
It's for a date. It's not... That website seems like it's like just hooking you up for sex.
And you're also, according to why these people are so mad, you were supposedly supposed to be guaranteed confidentiality. That nobody would find out about it.
Yeah, but they didn't expect they were going to get hacked.
Right, but the thing I can't grip my head around is that I'm not sure if it's more disgusting that 40 million people are just openly cheating on their spouse, or is it that 40 million people are now angry because this list became public, and now these people are quote unquote. Outrage. I mean, they actually use
that.
Yeah,
I see what you're saying.
Quote, unquote, is it more disgusting?
It's funny that the people that were cheating are mad that they got...
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, which is
funny.
Worse? The fact that not only are you a sleazeball, a couple 1-2 sleazeballs over here, or is it worse that you were okay with it, but now that it became public, you're outraged? I mean, they have in quotes on these websites that people are just outraged. Well, how about the fact that you're cheating on your spouse? I mean, which is so...
Oh, it's a little violin. No one's hearing their cries.
So it's a little bit of a... It's a little bit of a... I wouldn't even call it a catch-22. I would just say it's a little bit of a funny situation that these people would get... Are all hell-bent on getting their revenge on whoever these people are that exposed them and are mad at the website when the only people they have to blame are themselves and... You know, and that's the problem.
But Josh probably standing here is looking in the mirror.
Just look in the mirror, man. If you're not happy in your relationship, then I think you should probably just not be with that person.
I think you should go on Ashley Madison. Sign up for the deluxe.
Kyle thinks Ashley Madison. I think Ashley Madison is a disgusting website.
Hey, Josh, what? You plugged.
How would you feel if you got cheated on and somebody was using Ashley Madison? You were married, you had kids, and all of a sudden you came home one day, you went on this website, and you saw that your wife's name was on that website.
Well, of course I feel like shit.
Well, but I'm just saying, and then not only that...
But I don't blame the website, like a website for existing. Like, you can start a company. I mean, in fact, people use it. Like, that's their problem.
Well, I don't know. There's a lot of things I understand that, you know, everybody's got issues, man. And the one thing... You know, I could forgive people for a lot of things. I guess the one thing I could just never forgive somebody for...
Is using the internet.
No, is cheating. I think that's the one... I mean, that's the one thing that no matter what happens, you just... You know, once that happens, you can't ever take that back.
Yeah.
I know for me, if that ever happened to me, I could never take that back. Or I could never forgive that person because it's already... You know, that would just be the only thing ever
it
on your mind. And people... are on this website, 40 million. That's a lot of people that are just openly okay with
this. It's a Canadian company, Ashley Madison.
How do you know?
I looked into it.
You looked into it, huh?
I do my research. Yeah, it's
You looked
Canadian.
Into it, did you?
They're Canadian.
Huh.
Blame
a little
Canada.
Shade ball Buddha over here.
Blame Canada.
Little Buddha. Socialist. All right.
What's next?
Next, we got you know, we, real quick, a little disclaimer, real quick, before we talk about this. Me and Kyle have decided that we're not going to talk about politics on the show. Do you want to know why? Because you don't talk about politics. That's what, you know, you were raised at the dinner table. Religion, money, and politics. So three things you don't talk about at the dinner table. So we're certainly not going to talk about them here on Tandem Stance Podcast, which, by the way, TandemStance.com, iTunes, Podomatic, and the podcast up on your iPhone, you can find us at. We're certainly not going to talk about it on here. But I do have to say, Donald Trump.
That's like a complete having said that. Like everything you said before, the but doesn't matter.
It does, because we're not talking
we're
about...
We're not talking about politics.
Doesn't matter what side you're on. All I'm saying is...
So
you know,
we
it's
are
at least,
not going to talk about politics before we talk about politics.
Before we talk about politics. No, we're not talking about politics. We're talking about a politician
Okay.
who's a businessman. And I think it's funny that, you know, all these candidates, they're like robots. They say... They all say the same thing, but, you know, with a little bit of a different accent. They all try to get the same message across, depending on what party they're in. The thing I do enjoy about Trump is the fact that he's just mixing it up, and it's politics has finally become a little bit interesting. Politics may be one of those.
No, what you're looking for is entertaining.
Yes, I'm entertained.
Not interest but it shouldn't be entertaining. If he was running for governor, it wouldn't be a big deal.
I agree.
Like, that's fine. You're running for governor and you're making this. But, like, president, you control the greatest army the world's ever seen. You're in control of that.
I'm not saying that I'm going to vote for him. I'm just saying.
No, I know. People like him because he's honest and that he's not politically correct. But, like, there's a difference between not politically correct and being, like, crude. Like, calling Mexicans rapists and murderers isn't being not politically correct. It's being an ass.
Yeah, he's just being ignorant and rude. Exactly, 100%. I'm just saying,
it is
he's all over the news.
It is entertaining. It is entertaining.
We're on current events. It'd be weird if we didn't talk, at least mention the fact that he's entertaining.
If it wasn't so scary to me that he's like a front runner, I think it would be great.
Well, when it first happened, you know, the conversation was, this is kind of funny. Trump's running for president, ha ha ha. I mean, you take a look at those polls, those GOP polls. I mean, popularity-wise and, you know, the favoritism right now, I mean, he is not number one by... I mean, he's number one by a landslide.
It's a Saturday Night Live skit.
It's a Saturday Night Live skit.
If people said to you, like, 10 years ago, like, wrote a skit for SNL where it's like a debate skit and it's Trump going against Hillary Clinton 10 years ago, that's like a comedy routine.
Right. And everybody would watch it and love it and it would sell.
It's scary on both sides. Who knows?
Speaking of which... Do you watch Jimmy Fallon? Do you watch the lip sync battles on Jimmy Fallon?
I've seen him.
Anybody who's watching or listening to Tam Sands podcast right now, do yourself a favor. When you get a moment, go to YouTube, type in Jimmy Fallon, type in lip sync battles, and enjoy. They're fun.
Why? What does this do, Dan?
Joseph Gordon-Levitt is not only a great actor, but it's a lip sync battle. That's all it is. And these guys really get into it. Jimmy Fallon, what I like about it is Jimmy Fallon doesn't just sit back and have his guest. He's involved in the process. He's one of the people that is battling. And they all pick a song from one another, and they lip sync it. And, I mean, they get into it, and it's funny, and it's good fun. It's just a fun thing to watch. And every time I've watched one, I've almost cried laughing, and I've just had a great time watching it.
I've seen him on YouTube.
I'm just saying, speaking of SNL skits, it reminded
me
of Jimmy
Fallon.
I was
wondering what the segue was.
Segue there was, we were talking about SNL skits.
Not bad.
What else is going on, current events? Anything? Anything in this crazy world we live in?
That's really it for me. I think we got that off our chest.
We did. Really quickly, they did just announce, and they announced it today, so the only reason why I'm bringing it up, is Ronda Rousey has a new opponent. For January 2nd, her name is Holly Holm. She is a world champion boxer, world champion, I want to say kickboxer, but I know she's definitely she's either a world champion boxer or world champion Muay Thai boxer, kickboxer, who made the transition into MMA. The problem there is, you know, she's undefeated. You know, that's going to be their sales pitch, is that she's undefeated, Ronda's undefeated. The problem is that she knows nothing on the ground. I mean, she knows some things.
She's
going to
get a whole ass kicked. Is what
all I'm saying here is, Josh Prawl said it. Dr. Prawl said it first. This is going to be another 20-second fight. Save $65. Don't press buy.
Don't press buy.
All she's going to do is dodge one or two punches. Get in close. Get below her. Take her hips down. A little judo throw. Quick submission. It's going to be all said and done. And they just got to... They just gotta get, you know, and I'll tell you what, they really kind of screwed over Misha Tate. Misha Tate was, she just won her fight, and Dana White had came out and said the winner of this fight, it was
Wait,
Misha
so
Tate.
They just didn't, I thought she got hurt, I would assume.
On the last card, the one before Ronda Rousey, the big pay-per-view, I forget her opponent, but whoever won that fight was supposed to be up next. Dana White said, whoever wins this gets Ronda Rousey.
Yeah, but they probably figured out no one's going to buy that anyway.
Right, so they pretty much promised her that she was going to get Ronda Rousey because she won. Then, without even saying anything to her, boom, they gave her to Holly Holm. Holly Holm. So you heard it here first.
I agree. I concur.
Don't press buy.
All right, we're going to do some fan questions. This one's from Michelle Lantman from Hoboken, New Jersey.
Okay, what is Michelle... What's Michelle saying? Kyle read them this week, so I'm not familiar with the questions until right now.
Good, that's good. You're going to come up with fresh responses. I'm an acute care physical therapist working in a hospital setting. I have a hard time rating my patient's pain level because I usually use a scale of 0 to 10, 0 being nothing, 10 being hospital bad, but we are in a hospital. I compare the 10 to labor, but this has no relation for men. I was wondering what you refer to as a 10 out of 10 pain when you talk to your patients.
That is a really good question, actually.
I thought it was good. And I think we should start with doing, what is your 10 out of 10? Like, what's your top three pain in your life? You were a fighter, so.
Top three.
So what's your top three? I can go mine first if you got to think about it.
You go ahead.
One. When I got my nose reset, when I broke my nose.
Did you say broken?
When I got it reset, not when I broke it.
They didn't. I think they put you under for that.
They can, and they have, but they didn't put me under.
Brutal, huh?
That was brutal. I forget what they gave me some type of pain pill before Vicodin.
Didn't help at all, huh?
And they put two gauze pads soaked with liquid cocaine up my nose. Didn't help at all. That was the worst.
Was it supposed to just numb the area?
Yeah, like a local. Ooh. Like a local. But
so it's like a lidocaine. I guess they actually use cocaine quite a bit.
Yeah,
it was liquid
cocaine. It wasn't like, yeah, I mean, they're not giving me a line. I'm not Tony Montana before I go.
Tony Montana.
Before I go in to get my nose reset. That was number one. Two would be I fell longboarding and I shattered my pisiform in my hand and my hammy. That hurt.
When was that?
That was high school too. That must have been 16 years old.
Was it sticking out?
No. It's the bone shattered under there. It was closed. Ooh. I mean, my hand was a mess. I didn't wear a cast.
You know why? Because you're tough as nails.
Tough
as nails.
That's probably tough.
Buddha.
No, I recently got a tattoo. So if I would say the nose getting reset was my 10, my hand was like an 8.
Yeah.
Getting a tattoo inside of my bicep, I would say it's about a 3 or 4. So don't use tattoo. Is I guess. My long, 10 out of 10, I don't know what child labor feels like, but that seems to be a consistent one with women. To say 10 out of 10, just say, you can literally say 10 out of 10 is getting, I'm sawing your leg. That's 10 out of 10. That's as worst as pain can get if you're getting your leg sawed in half. People say 10 out of 10, they should be able to talk to you if they're in 10 out of 10.
Yeah. Two things. One, the answer to what you originally asked is what I think is... I broke a rib fighting.
Okay. Yeah,
I broke a rib.
Ribs are bad.
Before I got into MMA, I had three Muay Thai matches. 3-0. Hashtag 3-0.
Pat yourself on the back.
Hashtag 3-0. Pat myself on the back. Hashtag I'm awesome.
I'm undefeated too.
In my second Muay Thai fight, I took a kick. And at the time, you don't really know what's going on because the adrenaline is just pumping and you're just, you know, once the fight gets going, after the first few punches, you're just in this crazy zone. Adrenaline's pumping. You really have no idea what's going on. You don't feel anything really until the next day. I mean, it's funny because you think nothing happened to you. You wake up the next day, you barely got out of bed. But I took a, what was a liver kick, and I didn't block it properly, and I broke my rib on my left side. I knew something bad happened because, like I said, typically during the fight, you know you're going to hit, but you don't feel it. I felt that one, like, instantly. I was like, oh, boy, this is not good. And I had to guard that. It was in the second round. There were three-round fights, three-minute rounds. That one went, I won by decision, but it went the distance. And in between rounds, I knew something wasn't right. And the next day, I mean, you can't breathe. You can't cough. You can't laugh. Broken rib is absolutely brutal. So for me, that's really, I mean, that I think that would be probably the biggest, you know, broken bones in general, but the broken rib specifically is because you can't breathe. You can't laugh. It's even, it hurts to eat. All that stuff. So that would be my 10. What I tell patients is, you know, everybody, you know, I say, you know, when I first started off, I'd say, okay, you know, when your pain's at its worst, last couple days when your pain's at its worst, zero being nothing, you know, 10 being, you know, the worst pain you ever imagined. Oh, 10. It's 10.
10 out of 10.
Okay, you're not sweating, you know, you're not crying, you're not screaming in pain, right? You're sitting here talking to me, you walked in, you drove here. I don't think that's a 10. So what I started doing was I said, hey, zero's nothing. 10 is, I have to, pain so bad, me and you have to get in the car, I have to get in the emergency room right now.
Right, but this person works in a hospital.
All right, that's what I'm saying. That's my version of it.
Right.
So for a hospital worker, that's a tough question because...
I would say saw off the leg. I'm not even joking. If you took a knife and I started cutting into your leg, that's 10 out of 10. Because it's not going to be... No one should be in 10 out of 10 if they're talking to you.
If they can hold a conversation with you...
That's why the scale's even more.
Right. If they can hold a conversation with you and they're not, again, no symptoms. Like, they're not sweating. They're not getting red in the face. They're not shaking. They're not moaning. And they're able to just have a casual conversation with you. That is not a 10. So, but that's gonna be tough. So, what was the actual question, though? I mean, she
wants to know how you would relate. You know, it's funny though, because I had a patient once, a guy, and I'm like, zero is no pain, 10 is you have to go to the hospital. And he goes, oh, I thought 10 was child labor. And I'm like, I'm like, yeah, it is, I guess. But
right.
Like, how would you know?
You
know, like, I just thought it was. I'm like, yeah, buddy, but
you'd think though that probably is the 10, right? I mean, you got to imagine that's the 10.
That's the 10,
right? Has to be.
Say child labor if it's a woman, and if it's a man, just come up with it. It doesn't make or break.
I think broken bone. I think for guys, it's pretty safe to just say broken bone or.
Some people never broken a bone though.
Or maybe getting shot, getting stabbed.
Feels like getting stabbed.
Our one friend.
Yeah, if
your
patient's
mention over
been
the air,
shot,
he works in acute care.
Stabbed.
And he works in a rough section of, I think it's either New Jersey or New York. I can't remember.
Well, this person lives in Hoboken.
Okay, so there you go.
Miss Michelle Lampman.
So Michelle, you work in acute care. It's Hoboken. What's the next exit? Jersey City. So. When we went to go visit our friend Hoboken over New Year's, Jersey City, remember it was tough to find parking?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, people that work in the Jersey City hospitals,
they see stab wounds, they see gunshot wounds
all the time.
I like how you're correlating rough neighborhoods with trouble finding parking. If you have trouble finding parking, you might get stabbed or shot.
Well, no, I'm just saying, I'm just trying to give you an idea of like the kind of place I'm talking about. You know, our friend, you know, I tell him, oh, this person's got a 10 out of 10 pain because they threw their back out. And our friend will tell us, well, yeah, I'm getting people up that, you know, got shot in the street the other
mm-hmm.
night.
They're
in the hospital because they got
stabbed. Yeah. If you've been shot or stabbed.
We, in outpatient, we don't really see the stabs and the gunshot wounds so much.
It'd be funny to say, though.
So... You'd
come
have to
something
so
new
maybe a gunshot wound, maybe a stab, something like that would be the 10. But that's how I approach it with people. I say zero is nothing, you know, in outpatient. 10, we got to go right to the emergency room right now.
I don't think you should be overly concerned about it.
But it was a good question though, because that's you know the they always say you know,
I'm not
pain is one of the hardest
question.
Things to
I
pain
just,
is one of the hardest things to judge because everybody's version of 10 it could be different.
All right, you ready for the next one?
I am ready for the next one.
All right. This one's from Jordan Cameron. out of Easton, Pennsylvania. Easton. Okay.
Jordan Cameron.
Jordan.
Okay, what's Jordan asking? What's Jordan up to?
I'm a PT student. My CI takes over and does not let me do many of the treatments. I have not even done an initial evaluation, and I'm 3 weeks into my fourth fill. Advice to breaking the ice so I can do more. Advice about breaking the ice. I like the way that sounds.
Ooh, well, for starters, that is not a good situation to be in. Because by your fourth rotation, which would be your last, you should be seeing a full caseload by yourself, right? That's what it is. I think the scale is for that. Remember that?
Yeah,
scale?
By the end.
I think it's a...
I mean, this question is...
Yeah, but it's... I mean, it's...
Three weeks.
Yeah, so they're probably halfway through their...
So
Jordan, you're halfway through your pretty much your last clinical. I think it's safe to say that you should be not only doing evals, but you should be seeing at least 80-90% of the caseload.
We don't know a whole lot, though. It could be a heavy Medicare.
What would you suggest? I know what I would do. Let's say, what would you suggest he do in that situation? He's probably listening to this right now, wondering what, like, he's looking for the answer now.
I'm going to stop you there. Jordan could be a female name, but whatever.
Oh, that's true. I apologize.
I would, there's two routes. Either tell your school, whoever's in charge of the clinical, to break the ice for you, but that's kind of taking the easy way out. I would assume, just go up to them and just say, hey, I'd like to do, can I do this next eval by myself, or can I do this treatment, or can we practice on you so you know I can do it, like I do an eval with you, I want to start doing more evals, something like that, or just tell your teacher. That's the easiest answer. But
I definitely
don't think
you tell your teacher, because I'll tell you why. If I was a CI, if I'm a clinical instructor, and I think, you know, it appears on the surface that we've got an open line of communication, me and the student. We're talking back and forth all day, you know, we're doing whatever. And all of a sudden I get a phone call from that kid, a man or woman's school, saying, hey, why aren't you? I would be a little upset that he or she went behind my back, went to their teacher, instead of bringing me to the side and having that conversation.
Yeah, but you don't know the mentality of the CI.
Sure, sure. But I mean, you know, you're working in a health profession. I mean, you have to learn how to take initiative, and you have to learn how to. So Jordan, I mean, here's the deal. It's kind of one of those deals where you just have to suck it up and say, man, this is going to be an uncomfortable conversation. But, you know, I would ask to talk. I would grab your CI before the workday starts and just say, hey, can I talk to you for just a couple minutes real quick? I just want to go over some things, you know, privately. You know, when you get into that private situation, you know, try not to make it about you, or try not to make it seem as though you're upset with the way the CI is doing their job as an instructor. I would just say, you know, you want to start doing more evaluations and you want to start seeing more patients so that you could be ready for that first job. If you're in your fourth clinical, that means you're probably, you know, your clinical is probably wrapping up soon, and you're probably going to be, you know, either done with school or, you know, not much school left.
4 weeks left. I think some schools go to end of September.
Well, they do, and then they have that last semester before, you know,
no,
girl I work with, they graduate in January.
I mean, like, there's people now on clinicals for 4 more weeks. So.
Right, but they graduate in January. There's a lot of people that do
right,
winter graduation. Like, the girl I work with, their school graduated in the, actually, both my director and the girl I work with, who's a staff therapist, both went to the same school, and they graduated in January, so they're probably wrapping up. I would just approach it like, hey, you know, I really want to get more practice in. I don't feel as though I'm getting enough practice. Tell them you want to be ready to work your first job, you know, come January, and that, you know, you just don't feel like you're being prepared by taking the back seat. You know, try to stay away from any conflict or...
Listen to Josh, but if you get scared, just tell your teacher.
I mean, if you really can't do it on your own, I don't think that's probably not a good sign for how you're going to do with conflict in the future. I would really try to handle this one on your own, and just do not make it in a way where your CI is in a bad light and you're questioning how they're doing as a teacher. You know, make it all about you. Just say, listen, I just don't feel like I'm being, you know, getting prepared for that first job that I have coming up, and I really just want to, you know, start doing more evals and, and start seeing majority of the caseload. I know when I was, my last clinical was at Riptide Physical Therapy, and I had a great time, but I had a very open, honest conversation with them my first day. So, Jordan, if you have another internship coming up, remember this for your next one. First day, day one, I had a conversation saying,
but for everyone who does,
for anybody else who's listening, just right away, avoid that by saying, this is what I expect out of it. You know, you the CI probably has a very specific expectation, but you want to tell them, hey, my expectation is that I'm going to be seeing a lot of people, and I'm going to be ready for that, you know, that first job coming out of school, entry level, you know, doing evals on my own, doing all the notes on my own, doing all the treatments on my own, you know, being able to juggle multiple patients in the room at once. If you take a job, I'll tell you what, if you take a job at an outpatient clinic and you haven't been in that situation where you have three or four people there at one time and you have to juggle three or four people, you know, fit in their manual therapy, you know, try to grab this person halfway through, grab their manual therapy, this person in the beginning, this person in the end, just so it all works. That's a skill that you have to develop over time. And the only way to get good at that is by actually going and doing it. So for sure, Monday morning, have that conversation. And hopefully you listen to this before Monday morning and you can, you know, use some of this advice. I mean, what do you think, Kyle? I mean, that's what I would say. Well, Kyle says, hey, if you don't feel comfortable,
ask you. Backup plan is ask you, teach you.
Ask you, teach you.
Ask you, teach you. So what do I do? I'm nervous.
What do you do if you're in a practical and somebody turns the stim machine, Russian stim on 100% and he's your best friend and you don't want that kid to fail? Did
you
that ever happen to you?
Suck it up. That sounds like something that might have happened. I don't remember a whole lot from school.
Oh, that was funny.
I wing most of my treatment. I tell that to patients all the time. I don't even really work here.
I'm just winging it.
I'll be stretching out until the end. I don't even really work here. I used to work for UPS.
I snuck in. So that's that. I mean, what else we got? I think that's it. That's right about it. So just to hear you guys one last time, you could hear this voice and hear Kyle's voice. This is the conclusion of episode 2 of the Tandem Stance podcast. Again, we're going to be putting out the special test videos very soon. One of our dear friends, who's one of our professors, we're going to get him involved. We're going to have charts up with specificity, sensitivity, you know, references for every special test that we feel is important. Head to toe, every special test on the website, tandemstance.com. We'll have that by the fall. We'll always have, you know, research articles and stuff on tandemstance.com. We're going to be updating that as much as we can. For the podcast, iTunes, Podomatic.com, podcast app. Also, follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Facebook is Tandem Stance, and Instagram and Twitter is @TandemStance. Again, the support and the fan questions have been awesome so far.
Awesome.
Every week they get better and better, and they get more and more. And we're glad you guys are enjoying it. We're getting some really good feedback. And, you know, me and Kyle certainly enjoy doing it. And much love. I appreciate it.
Thanks,
bottom
y'all.
Of my heart. Thanks, y'all. Have a good weekend. Peace.
Peace.